This is going to be a big year for us.
I promise to fight for the living.
Man har rustat sig för ett litet krig där ute i skogen.
What is the budget for our show?
Smaller than it was.
Yeah, not big enough.
Hi everyone and welcome to episode number 51 of Streamingpodden with me, Jonas Birmi, and Magnus Svensson from Iron Technology. It's a podcast about video streaming tech and with a focus on open source. Today we have a guest, Romain Bocot from Motion Spell, who will be introduced a little bit later who he is. And before we start, Magnus, we just got back from NAB in Las Vegas. What's your impression from that show this year?
It was a great show, I would say. I'm still recovering from the jet lag, but I think we're getting back to closer to where we were before pre-pandemic. I think this round year is about 65,000 visitors, and the atmosphere was closer to back to normal. I think it was a lot of... What we reacted on pretty quickly was that all the booths are one size smaller than previous years. I feel that most vendors are downsizing the booth size, but still the presence is there, and I think it's more about networking and meeting people, discussing the industry, than showcasing things in a standard booth.
Did you see any open source talks or open source components on the show that you...
I saw a bit on open source, and I think there is getting more traction in the industry now, and honestly less buzzwords in the booths than I've seen before, and it's more focus on pure technology and stabilizing the industry.
And one of the users of open source that we know about is Netflix. There are others, but that's one example. And one of those components they are using is a component basically from our guest today, Romain Bocot. And we're really happy to have you here. Were you at NAB?
Yes. So first, thanks for having me. Yes, I was at NAB. And I'm pretty convinced that exactly what you said, there is some traction around open source. When I read last year's Bitmovin report, I saw that people were really concerned about cost. And I think open source is not all about cost. There is no free lunch, right? But at least the license cost is zero. So I think it's an important, you know, factor for people to go to open source. And there are some other factors, but I think we're going to discuss them later.
So before we jump into that, I mean, as you say, open source, what many people think about when you think about open source is it's free and reduced cost and all those things. But we will talk more about sort of the commercial application of it as well. And also, I think, discuss a little bit around the sustainability and all those things. But before we do that, Romain, please tell us a bit about yourself for our audience. Who are you and what have you done?
I'm a geek. I'm a geek and a musician. So I did a lot of music when I was younger, and I got a little bit by chance into electronics up to the point where, you know, we got these Nintendo's game systems. I was, you know, playing all the time when I was 10. And when I was 12, my father bought a computer. And he was responsible for buildings, like for public buildings. And one day, some guys from the university where I lived came at home with some disks with the GCC compiler. And so they explained to me that I could, you know, write my own games and programs and whatever. And so when I was 13, my father, who was not at all into computers, as I said, he was into buildings, offered me a book about the C computing language. So, of course, I couldn't understand all the things that were in this book, and I was not able to do many things at first. But as years passed by, I became a programmer. I became a full geek. I had computers with all kind of operating systems and Linux at home. When I got an access to the internet, it was open... eye-opening for me that there were many people like me, in fact, that were trying to do things and that we could contribute together. It just opened doors for me. So I continue to, you know, do much things in musicianship, And so I was a classical musician. I was learning the trumpet, but I was also playing some piano because, you know, when we do music at a certain level, you have to play several instruments, and especially instruments being able to emit several notes at the same time to do some harmony. And at some point, I had some bands with some friends in the engineering school, and I wanted to combine both. I wanted to do music and computer engineering, but I failed, and I went into video instead. And that's how I came to video streaming. It was a challenge. Actually, I'm telling a little more, too much maybe, so let me know if I need to stop. But it was a challenge at the time. AVC was the really, really new codec when I was out of school. And one guy mm-hmm. came from a company that was Allegro, so now they've been bought partially by Atem, and they are doing IP that you can find on system and chips. Like, I cannot tell the customers, but on, you know, many IP customers. And they had this problem of going multi-core. And I had taken courses, you know, by chance, on JPEG 2000. So I had already made, that was Motion JPEG 2000, actually. So we had combined, you know, everything to make a simple codec. And I had taken lessons, of course, on concurrency, parallelism. And so they got me for an internship. And that's how, you know, all started. I had been there for 4 years. Then I moved to Telecom Paris Tech because they were editing the JPEG open source software. So I had contributed to JPEG, but I didn't know who was behind. And at some point in my company, we said, okay, that's French people in a university. So, okay, they should come and train us. So the guys came. And actually, a few years after that, I went to Paris. I went to Telecom Paris Tech. And 3 years after that, I made the company that, you know, is the commercial arm of the open source JPEG software. So really great story. And I've been doing this for 10 years. And so last year we were able to make a press release with Netflix, as you said, you know, using extensively open source and using our packager, but they are not the only one. And I'm trying to, you know, create this traction where the companies also communicate on the fact that they use open source, they contribute to open source, either JPEG or other projects. They were the guys from FFmpeg and VLC at NAB with a booth. That was, I think, a first. And also contributing to the sustainability. And you told me that, you know, maybe you had questions about this. So that's for later.
Do you have any contact still with the original authors of JPEG at the university?
Yeah, absolutely. And the story of JPEG is a bit crazy. So that was a student and in the 90s. And in the 90s, people had a lot of ideas. That was really the beginning, and they made, you know, Second Life, and then it was Flash. And there was an open, you know, possibility around it that was MPEG-4. So that was a set of standards that was supposed to be the open Flash stuff and going beyond. I don't know, they were taking drugs or whatever, but they had really tons of ideas at that time. Everything seemed wide open. And so he made a year off working in a company during his studies. So that's Jean Lefebvre. He's the creator of JPEG, and he's still working on a project. Really, really genius guy. And he decided to make a company in New York City. And the company failed because that was the .NET bubble, you know, that was the end. Mm-hmm. And he came back to France in the university. So everything was open source because the university had IP problems. They were licensing stuff and they were not able to use their stuff anymore. So they said, at least if we open source it, we will be able to continue using it on the, you know, using the open source license. And that's how JPEG became license. So first GPL, then LGPL, and then adding this dual licensing stuff with commercial licenses for companies, because using free software, the GNU licenses, is a bit tricky for companies. Like, you need to mention that you're using the software with, you know, the name of the copyright holders. You need to allow reverse engineering. So it can be, you know, tricky on some part.
So explain a little bit, how does this dual licensing, as you mentioned, work? How is it set up?
Yeah, so actually, I contacted all the copyright holders, all the people having rights on the code, and I proposed them a deal where they get money when I sell the software. And this is not that I wanted to give them money, but I wanted to consolidate the community around JPEG so that if people want to live off their art, they can. Because everything is about communities in open source. And, you know, there are many problems when dealing with communities. Maybe you went to some mailing list on some other open source software. You know, you need to find a way to make it, you know, sustainable with, you know, everybody behaving correctly and understanding the different goals. For me, this is, I wouldn't say this is a nightmare, but sometimes, you know, the interests of the individuals are really contradictory because we have a real open source free software basis. And then there is this commercial stuff where, you know, we're doing things that basically deprive users from freedom. I'm thinking about, you know, DRMs or inserting, you know, ads or whatever, which are things that are really not popular in the free software communities.
So how were your approach received? Was it a lot of negotiations or convincing or how was that?
Yeah, so it took some time. It definitely took some time. But you know what is key is that that's the trust. Business is trust. So what I need to do is to be transparent and to give people all the information they need, you know, around what's happening. It's always about saying, you know, to people what we're doing, where we are, you know, heading for, what kind of features we need, what we can do for them. Actually, a lot of people are really happy to be able to do open source for a living. I think that when they have the choice, you know, sustainability, there are many... I think it in many, how would you say that? In many, it fulfills, you know, a people to be useful and to feel that what they are doing is not only, you know, to make money for a company.
And I think that, I mean, at least a bit apart from myself is that what I enjoy with open source and contributing to those projects is that what you do is visible. I mean, it's like... I mean, if you would work only on sort of proprietary code and closed source and all things, everything you do, you could do smart solutions or algorithms or whatever, but no one would see that, actually. It's all in the hands of a closed black box. But being part of the open source community is you both are you challenged, but you're... What you do is your work is also visible for others, and also if that can inspire someone or get someone to learn writing better code. I'm not saying I'm the best coder, but let's say I would inspire someone in, okay, you can solve it this way or that way. I think that's for me is personally is a rewarding thing. But of course, I mean, I want to make a living as well, so it's all that combination which is not always easy, especially when you start a project from scratch, more of a passion project, and you do it on the side, and it's not maybe a business around it from the start. And I think that as you said in the beginning here, that the perception of open source for many is that it's free, and you choose that because of cost reasons. But to me, at least, that it's more. What's your view, Magnus, on this?
I think that I was just about to say, I think the industry is about to change, and I think it's the understanding of open source and the business models around open source and that the community, like you said as well, is getting more and more traction. I think more and more people are understanding the benefits of open source and the monetization structure of open source, that is not licensed, but still there are no free lunches. There are money flows somewhere, and I think with Spotify and a couple of other companies in the line here that actually start contributing back and start giving money back to the open source communities is helping as well.
Yeah, I think you both said really interesting things. So Jonas, you told something that is really, in my opinion, core on this. what makes open source projects so successful is that often at the beginning, it's like a business. People start with a pain point. They want to do something. They are passionate about it. And because they're passionate about it, they progress really quickly. And by doing this, we are creating open source software where, for example, at GPAC at the core, there are like three contributors that are really highly skilled. And I guess, you know, it's the same in VLC, that's the same in FFmpeg. Actually, it's the same in any company where you have a few individuals who, you know, gathered a sum of information and they become critical. So that's the first thing that I wanted to say. Before getting money for what you do, it's like being an entrepreneur. There's, at first, there are people who are passionate, and then like any company, there is a bit of luck on the timing, on what you're doing, will it become, you know, popular or whatever. For example, on AI, there are people, you know, working on side projects and everything kicked off totally by chance. 10 years ago, we made a company. I remember we were doing 360 video. When I was trying to negotiate the IP right, it took me so much time that some people proposed me to join as a CTO of a company. So that was a photograph doing 360 photos. And he found someone to do some, so I used to do some GPGPU, so highly parallelized on, you know, GPUs for video encoding. And they were, you know, using the GPUs with CUDA, that was the beginning at the time, to stitch the photos together. And they discovered that it would be near real time. And they were looking for someone to take care of the video streaming and shipping software, because I had a track record of shipping since I was in open source, and we had this open source working, you know, software working everywhere. So they hired me for that. And suddenly, so we were a tiny, you know, small specialized niche company that was, we were doing great, and we had customers. When we made the beta, people were sending us gifts. So we were at the right time, and suddenly Facebook bought Oculus for $2 billion. And we began to be in the middle of the storm where, you know, everything exploded. It's like 100 times more sales from day zero to day one. It was just so crazy, right? You need to be ready for all of this. And it's like being an entrepreneur. That's exactly the same. You may be good at starting project, but not good at, you know, growing it up to a certain point or, you know, and it's really challenging. The transparency, as you mentioned, also is really, really challenging. Like, people can have an eye on your work. When you're in the corporate space, I think you guys are more on the corporate space, it's okay. But if you go to the mailing list of FFmpeg or even on our bug tracker on GPAC, some people are really, really picky. When there is a bug, they don't admit that it's a problem. They just say it's a shitty project and whatever. And so, you know, that's also the public opinion that people have. Sometimes you discuss with companies and they come to us and they say, you know, we evaluated the code of GPAC and we thought that you would never do that if the code was closed. Maybe the code from the competitor is, you know, super dirty at some parts or whatever. And nobody knows. They don't cover as much, you know, they don't have as much users as we have. They don't cover as much platforms as we do. They are not transparent. They're not answering publicly to their users and whatever. So, you know, and when it comes to what you said, Magnus, around the open source, you know, business, I think that on our side, we tried, I have all the cards in my hands. We've been here for, you know, the project has been popular. We're doing research. We're doing standards. We've been incredibly successful and lucky regarding ISO BMFF. So we are advocating in GPAC for ISO BMFF, and we actually were able to put ISO BMFF everywhere. Productions, ProRes, Qt, the QuickTime file formats, that's ISO BMFF. All the mezzanine today, ISO BMFF. Anything being distributed today is basically CMAF. So there is a little bit of MPEG-TS still, but, you know, disappearing to that ISO BMFF. People doing archiving, ISO BMFF. I can sell licenses. Not all the open source projects can sell licenses, right? I can do it. FFmpeg can't, VLC can't, Media Info. So now they are BSD, I think, or MIT license because of the licensing problems. I can do dual licensing. I have a team. We can do support. We can do trainings. We've made a lot of trainings in all the companies that allowed me, you know, to be known in the industry. Otherwise, you know, how would people know me? But, you know, they needed the knowledge, and I came to them and, you know, try to bring the knowledge. I have all the cards. There is no business model. There is no real business model on it. We have to make products that would work like any other products. And now we're trying to, with this Netflix and stuff, so I accepted to talk with you, and I'm not a public person, right? I'm a geek. I like to be home and code. But we need to go out at some point and say to the people, this is critical infrastructure. For example, my competitors, like Bento4, so FFmpeg, they miss a lot of features and compatibility on the ISO BMFF CMAF MP4 space. Bento4, they've had no maintainer for 4 years. Shaka Packager, the two maintainers, have said for years that they had no time for this, and now they left Google. So at some point, it's like, you know, what happens if FFmpeg disappears? What happens if JPEG disappears? What is the cost for the industry? And that's why I'm talking about these critical infrastructures. There is a point where people need to contribute back. So I welcomed when some companies like Netflix openly says, we're going to give them money just to, you know, do our part in contributing in a sustainable environment. We depend on them. And so it's normal that, you know, we sustain this environment where we think this is useful. And so now, you know, I'm adding a card to my game also, so that, you know, we can also reach a size that is acceptable. A software like JPEG, like, you know, being developed for 20 years, the public estimation, which is close to the private estimation, is that it costs around $15 million to distribute over 20 years. We basically need $1 million every year to sustain what we're doing, the research, the training of students, the standardization, the software, the commercial activity. So this is not so big, right? A business with $1 million is of revenue is not so big. But when you're open source only, that's a lot of money that you need to grab, because when people give you money, it's like typically $10,000 that they give to you. So it means that you need to find 100 companies giving this kind of money to you. And then that's a different story. So open source, really good. Business model, more complex.
So if you would, I mean, are there any things you should think about, let's say, when I would start a new open source project, solving some pain points that I've identified or some have. Is there any license, open source license, I should be careful about, or really thinking through what I should choose here in the beginning in order to be able to have a sustainable business model around that later on if that picks up? What would be your suggestion?
It really depends what your goals are. I mean, personally and commercially. I would, if I had to start, all my projects will be with the most viral open source licenses like AGPL that no company wants. But on the other side, I would try to do what we've been able to do in JPEG, which is to, you know, keep the control of the IP so that you can dual license. I think in a lot of projects now, there are CLAs, contributor license agreements. Excuse me. On the other side, if you have a project that is really, really popular and that is really B2C, like your VLC, I think you need to have a have a different strategy. You need to be more open in what you do. Otherwise, people like individuals wouldn't accept to sign a CLA to contribute. They will just go to GitHub and make a pull request, and that's all. You cannot expect them to sign papers. So it really depends on what you want to do. But, you know, at first you need to be passionate about what you do, because, you know, keeping up on all these things, especially in our industry, is catastrophic. During NAB, we've had a lot of discussions about the role of AI in our industry. Someone like me, I deal every day with, you know, every day, maybe not, but, you know, from day to day with dozens of specs of hundreds of pages. I am an average guy, right? I'm not a super genius with a second brain. I cannot, you know, handle so much stuff. I've been able to do this because I've been in the industry coding on this for 15 years. But if we want to train people, if we want to keep on having more and more complex and efficient technology, you know, AI may be a solution where they can read the specs, they can extract information. There is a really good company, Newsbridge, maybe you saw their booth. They're all into AI, they're indexing content. And I was, you know, talking with them about these things. You know, definitely that's possible. People are complaining that, you know, they say it's really a paradox, right? People say AIs are not intelligent, they cannot create anything. And at the same time, they say, you know, they are not strict enough. When you ask them questions, they can invent the output. So, okay, we need to find a middle where they can ingest a lot of data, they can provide you with the pointers, you can check the information, because actually that's what we're doing all day. Is this flag correct? Do I have tests for what I have coded? What is the exact what is the latest version of the spec? We're always dealing with, you know, these questions all day. And on our side, we're doing standards, but we're also doing a lot of conformance, compliance stuff. So there was this JCCP, so that's the -IF project on conformance, but also some other things where we have the people doing the standards to do better standards. So I have great hopes in this also. There are really real technical barriers, I think, in our industry to contribute. We're dealing with a technical stack that is, you know, fairly complex.
Great. I mean, it's really nice talking to you about these things. I hear you have a passion for what you do. And that's great. Magnus, will you do you have any other updates that you would like to share
I think I have two reflections actually very connected, because I think we discussed a lot of open source, and I think Romain mentioned at the beginning that one of the themes that we saw on NMAB was cost savings, efficiency, and these type of things. And that's when I think that companies are turning to open source, not because it's free, but to the freedom. They can actually choose to run open source, and they're not locked into a specific vendor or a specific technology or a specific proprietary code that they're sort of stuck with for the remaining 20 years. They can, if they go with open source, they can sort of open the box and see what they're getting, and they can at any point fork off and go on their own. So I think that's why I think open source in this industry actually get a quite some traction now these days, because of cost savings, efficiency, and these type of things. And Romain mentioned a very interesting point when it comes to dependencies, and I think that is a reflection I've done a couple of times as well, that we are dependent on a few guys with cones on their head making FFmpeg and VLC and these type of projects in the industry, and that is quite scary actually, if they decide to do something else, if they decide to move on. And another reflection I draw is also the dependencies we actually have in the industry of the cable TV and the cable TV industry. We see now people are going bankrupt, companies are going bankrupt because of the cord cutting and the money flow that comes from cable TV into sports and other streams that suddenly are not there anymore. Very few of the global streamers are profitable. So it's we're in a very interesting turmoil of the industry where we are doing cost savings because of the cord cutting. Is the money is not really there. There are no easy wins in the industry, and that's why I think this discussion has been very interesting on how dependent we can become of an open source initiative.
I mean, I remember, and this is a question maybe that has changed, but not that long ago, I think it was a couple of years ago, I had some discussions with different people working with some technology, and they were rather quite, I would say, hesitant, if that's the right word, of using open source, because they were scared to death about the licensing. They were so afraid that they would choose an open source project with a sort of wrong license that would sort of affect their IPs and their code. So they made a decision to not use that at all, right or wrong. But is this something that you have met, Romain, when talking to others, or is this maybe something that has is belonging to the past, rather?
Well, you mentioned that, and after that I will come back to the remark from Magnus. So we talked about this at the NAB streaming summit organized by Dan Rayburn, where I had the chance to talk with Netflix. In 10 years, everything changed regarding open source. 10 years ago, companies, you know, most of the time didn't want to use open source. Then they started to communicate about the fact that, publicly we can go to GitHub and open issues, and then they publish their own open source stuff. They open issues, they provided pull requests. Things have changed a lot. I think it's really good. And to come back to what Magnus said, there is still a lot of money in this industry. A lot. But it's just wasting this industry because the technical knowledge is just gone. And when it cut the cost, the first thing that it cuts is R&D. That's totally visible when you go to you look at research, or when you go to standardization, for example. A couple of years back, users were present at MPEG. You had companies like Harmonic, for example, profitable company. They were present. They were saying, yeah, you know, for the codec, you need to do this. Stop doing this for packaging the codec or whatever. These people are not present anymore. They're always making money. When they do research, it's to do patents. That's so sad. It shows, you know, how streaming came from being something, a real hard problem with passionate people, to a problem that is basically solved, and, you know, where, you know, people fight for, you know, whatever not interesting stuff. There is a lot of problems that still need to be solved. You know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago already, Apple made HLS. Worst decision in history. We're still battling with this. You know, how did we... I know how this happened. I was there, and I was so ashamed that we're trying to get out of this. But anyway... You know, HTTP, MPEG-TS. I remember I was at MPEG, it was a couple of years back, and someone said, you know, it's good and MPEG-TS works. I made a computation. It cost $1 billion per year in infrastructure to use MPEG-TS, like at the proportion that we had at the time. So we spent billions in infrastructures. This is what costs a lot, right? That's the physical stuff. You need to put cables, there are people, you need to find all the materials. $1 billion a year. Imagine if, you know, I took this $1 billion and I gave it to, you know, people doing open source. And for R&D, that's catastrophic, right? If nobody is doing R&D, what is going to happen? There is a lot of people contemplating and saying, hey, you know, the changes at MPEG, it's really good. And there are researchers like the people from JPEG. People use JPEG and are really happy about it. How? Because we are doing R&D. We have tons of features that just don't work, right? But when people came and said, hey, I want to try VVC, where do you go? You type VVC encoding, VVC packager, VVC decoder, you know, and you come to our project. What do you say if you say, I want to try WebRTC ingestion from the browser? You come to your project, Jonas. That's the only project that people can, you know, try. I wouldn't say try and buy, I don't know. But, you know, they can be in contact with you. They are real humans and, you know, doing the R&D. And, you know, as Thomas Starkhammer from Qualcomm said, that's also filling the bridge between, you know, the technology that's being created and the market. If there is a market need, of course, because there are some technologies that are being deployed, but there is no real need. So, you know, people don't take it. Like, for example, you know, at NAB, everybody was talking about ad customization, but customers just don't care. They are fed up with ads at the moment. So we need to do other things. But there are real technologies where, you know, people want to go into this technology. And then you're really happy. You're getting faster. Open source, R&D and open source are a great combination.
Yeah, I totally agree on that. And that's a little bit... The approach we have all had from the start with our R&D is basically that whatever we do, we publish, we release as open source, to sort of contribute in everything there. So I mean, of course, we have a business around other things in our company. I mean, we earn money from consultants in development and those services, but the R&D part is something we invest in ourselves. So we don't have any agenda of doing R&D to have patents. That's not the driving for us. That's our is to release it to the public, and has always been. So maybe that's a difference from other companies in that sense. And I think it's it's an interesting reflection, as you say. I mean that combining the R&D and open source is a way of getting things, trying out and all those things. So really cool. Before we conclude this episode, again, really nice having you here. Are there any open source project that you would like to recommend our listeners to have a look at, besides GPAC then, of course?
Linux. You can do so many things now. It's with computers, you know, don't go into closed computers. I think Windows has become... I've been a user of Windows actually until 2 or 3 years ago. My main computer was on Windows just because I needed to use Office and, you know, many of the tooling that we needed to communicate was not available, widely available. But now I'm using Linux. Everything is open. I like using open stuff. If you can use it, just use open stuff. Everything, like LibreOffice, really works great. You have open source tools everywhere. Even in my car to listen to music. I got crazy with the default software that they put in it. That's crazy. Like, if the speed is too small, there is something displaying saying that I cannot touch the screen, so I have to use the physical buttons when I'm going over a certain speed. You know, sometimes the Bluetooth, you know, doesn't work. They were getting me crazy, right? You just put a USB key and you can put an open firmware and you can do whatever you want, right? You can even play videos for the kids and whatever. That's just crazy, right? Why can't we do this? I'm not going to look at the show of my kids while I'm running. So I don't know, just crazy things. Instead of, you know, being locked in your life, you can be totally free. So Linux, I think, is people should try it. It works great. All of the hardware is recognized. It's really fast, and you have no bloatware. There is no virus. It's really, really, really secure. Just give it a try.
I mean, a side story there. I mean, I've been using Linux as well from basically start, and I remember one of the first thing I did, actually in some kind of contribution. I think it was. Creative or something that had an MPEG decoder card. Basically, it was used for playing DVDs. I think it was EM8300 or something that like that. Called. I don't know if you remember what it was, but it has only Windows drivers. I remember, but it was very simple because it had a firmware which you actually loaded into a bus. The code was available in that sense. So I remember I just wrote I contributed to a driver that actually took that loading that firmware into that card and developed that API or what you call it as a Linux module. I think that was the first video related, I would say, project I did work in. And this was, when was that, 2000 or something like that? So it's 23 years ago or something like that. But and you know why I did it? Because I was running Linux and I wanted to watch DVD.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you said. You had this pain point. Right. You wanted to solve it. That's how everything starts, right? You have these pain points. You want to solve them. And open source, it's a team game. Community is key. You need to get, that's like any company. You need to get the feedback from your users. But then what is really strong is that these users can, you know, become easily ambassadors and they can contribute in all ways, your documentation, your code, dealing with the issues, you know, public communication. It's all strong. We're, you know, together we're stronger. That's true.
All right, thank you, Roman, for being on this episode. Magnus, do you have any final words before we close this?
No, I think it's been a great discussion, and it's always really interesting to hear someone that passionate about open source and the video community. So it's been a great 40 minutes.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And everyone listening, thank you for listening. I hope you had a good time, and stay tuned for the next episode. We will continue with having guests, and the theme will continue to be open source and video streaming technology. So stay tuned for the next episode, and thank you this time, Magnus. Thank you, Roman. Thank you, everyone that's been listening. It's been a great episode. Have a good day, everyone, and bye.
Ni har lyssnat på Streamingpodden, en podcast för dig som är intresserad av streamingteknik och nyheter i området. Programmet produceras av Ivyn Technology, leverantörsoberoende specialister inom videoteknik och mediedistribution.